thank you for the quartet and the music. I'm glad Mr. Scruggs introduced that as being sort of metaphorical and not literal in nature. The song could give the wrong impression if we didn't understand it from that perspective. But very beautiful music and harmony. This is our fourth message in our series that we've been doing on the godly subject of marriage. In recent years, the rash of divorces has caused for great concern. And as you know, young couples who have given us great surprise by a large number, not only in the West, but also back East and in cities I've heard of in the middle part of the country, have, it seems like, lost sight of some of the concepts they ought to understand. My wife and I were in Tacoma. We were there pastoring for 13 years, never had a divorce. Only had one couple that separated, and they were not a couple that I had married or counseled or had a background in the Worldwide Church of God or United Church of God. They, in fact, came from an independent group, and the man was a former Mormon. That they were unwilling to counsel and talk, but as far as the rest of the church goes, those who were solid long-time members or teens or young adults getting married, it was 13 years of marital bliss, as far as I was concerned. And marital bliss in the church equates to pastoral bliss in the pastoral office. You can ask Mr. Dick or Mr. Duncan. But one of the couples that was north of us, in fact, several of them came down to counsel with my wife and I think several reasons. Perhaps they had known us from camp. My wife, of course, is the mother hen of the Northwest Summer Camp and knows the girls very well. In some cases, they just felt their pastor did not have the time for them, or they felt more comfortable talking to somebody else. That's not a great, big, huge problem. But I remember talking to one of the young men, and he said, well, it's like a real estate contract. If you agree to buy a house and you borrow money from the mortgage company and they renege on the deal, you're not responsible anymore. You can walk away. And I thought, wow, this guy doesn't understand anything. He does not understand the most important dimension in a marriage, and so today's sermon is going to be called The Missing Dimension in Marriage. People search for reasons. One of the tools on the internet, or one of the very popular websites, or you might call it fads of the recent years, is called TED Talks. How many have seen TED Talks on the internet? If you don't, it's a great resource. TED stands for Technology Entertainment Design, TED. It was founded in 1984 as a once-a-year conference that has grown into a much more frequent and annual event with the slogan of Ideas Worth Spreading. What can be better than hearing an engaging, informative, and sometimes profoundly moving talk in less than 20 minutes by some of the world's most prominent thought producers? There are over 1,500 TED Talks on YouTube. The subjects normally concern human relations, human accomplishment, things that we would consider as philosophical in nature. There are some others. One I heard recently that was, I thought, profound was the mother of Dylan Klebold, who murdered 12 students and one teacher in a high school in Colorado a number of years ago. She talks on TED Talks about what it's like to be the mother of a mass murderer and what happened to her life after that happened and how she was searching for reason. She did not even know her son owned a gun, much less had any of those issues. But profound in TED Talks is the subject, or I would say frequently in TED Talks, is the subject of marriage, and maybe more specifically, the subject of sex. I would warn you about listening to some of those. I probably listened off and on to parts of 10 to 15 of them in preparation for this message. And my big concern, because most of them I've simply turned off after a while, was that they were based on humanism, they're based on Gestalt psychology and other flawed pop psychology ideas, where they're searching around in these TED Talk presenters trying to find a reason for all of these divorces, reason for marriages not working. And the subjects they come up with, or the reasons they come up with, are, I would guess, just quite frustrating. You all know what the reason for divorce is. Jesus Christ said it very plainly, didn't he? Anyone not know? Anyone could not quote that for me word for word? Matthew 19. Jesus Christ said, because of the hardness of your hearts, God allowed divorce. What does hardness of your hearts mean? You all know that too. You all know the verse, right? You can quote it. Hebrews 3, verse 13. Hardness of your hearts is the deceitfulness of sin. So, divorce is allowed or was allowed because of sin. Where there is divorce, there is sin. There is not just incompatibility. One of the TED Talk presenters had been divorced and married three times by the time she's about 28, and she blamed it all on, quote, not finding the right person, which is totally not supported by the scriptures. Interesting how many great marriages in the Bible even were people who didn't know each other who got married. Rebecca and Isaac. And you have even like Ruth and Boaz, even though they knew each other, but we might say they would be, quote, incompatible because of age and other differences. There were others who got married because of lust and desire. Samson and the daughter of Timnah. How well did that turn out? Or relationship with Delilah. But that's for another time. There is one TED Talk I would enthusiastically recommend for all married couples. It's one I would show and have discussions on if we had a marriage seminar attended by only marriage couples. But when you listen to this, if you've been married more than a couple years, you unfortunately will see yourself over and over because what she says is true. It's called The Sex-Starved Marriage. Catchy title, isn't it? The Sex-Starved Marriage. The lady who does it is called Michelle Davis, Michelle Wiener Davis. She has a book out on that subject. But in 16 minutes, she gets to the heart of what is often wrong with marriages and the symptoms of that. Now, what is the missing key? I spoke about the young man who told me that marriage was like a real estate contract, that if the other person doesn't abide by making the monthly payments or whatever the contract says, then they can just walk away. They're not bound. The missing key is what everybody who was married in a church ceremony said. I printed out some words from the standard United Church of God wedding ceremony, which we use with some tweaks and some variances to accommodate the needs of certain couples. It was interesting, Mr. Dick a couple weeks ago mentioned that he was waiting for the time when a potential bride would come and ask that the word submit be taken out of the wedding ceremony. And I know it's happened to me twice. The first was in 1999, and this girl was determined that she was not going to have the word submit in her wedding ceremony. And I finally told her after the third request, I said, it's in the Bible, but if you can find a Bible that doesn't have that in it, then I will agree to it. But it has to be a real Bible, not some fake one. And so she couldn't find a Bible that had it in there, but even during the ceremony, she glared at me during that part of the, when I said that, do you honor and promise to submit to your husband? You know, but they're still married, so apparently she learned, or he learned, to say yes, dear, or whatever the old saying is. But notice what the wedding ceremony says. I, the husband gives his name, faithfully promise and covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses to take her name, to be my lawful wedded wife in sickness and health, in good times and in difficult times, as long as we both shall live, and as God has ordained to love her, cherish her, honor her, provide for her, and to be her husband. You see, the guy that thought that it was like a real estate contract didn't make his real estate contract as a covenant with God. In marriage, there are three agreed parties: the husband, the wife, and God, who ordained marriage and created us. And the big problem that leads to divorce is that husbands find faults with their wife, the wife finds fault with their husband, and neither one repents before God because they have violated their covenant with God. They see it in terms of boy, girl, man, woman only, and they forget that when they need to apologize to their wife for criticizing her, or in some cases striking her, or she needs to apologize to her husband for words that are sharper than a razor, They also need to get on their knees and apologize to God for violating the promise that they made to him. Then we ask the wife or the bride, and she says, I blank faithfully promise and covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses. She also makes a covenant with God to be her man's lawful wedded wife in sickness and in health, in good times and in difficult times. Why is it that we forget that? That so often, women especially, can't make it through the difficult times. The husband's sick, doesn't make enough money. I've known of women who said they were going to divorce their husband because he didn't make enough money. He promised to take care of her. He just didn't have enough money coming in. That's a case my wife could have divorced me every month for the first 10 years we were married. Because we struggled for a long, long time. And we had to take extra jobs and do all sorts of things. And there were times we had to fast and ask God to give us enough money for our rent because it was due and we couldn't pay it. And guess what happened? The next few days we both got jobs and our combined paychecks came on the day the rent was due, and it was just enough after first and second tithe to pay the rent. So God does answer our prayers and he does get us through. But wives promise to be a lawful wedded life, to love their husband, covenanting with God in good times and in bad times. Let's go to Psalm chapter 50 and verse 14. We are admonished in the Psalms, not once but three times, that we had better pay our vows to God. A young woman and a young man who stand before a minister of God in the front of hundreds of witnesses and promise in covenant with God to become husband and wife according to his guidelines are taking a vow. And they are, for the rest of their life, required to keep those vows to the Most High. Psalm chapter 50 and verse 14, very simple, offer to God thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Notice the next verse says, call on me in the day of trouble and I will deliver you and you shall glorify me. It's sort of the natural following of paying your vows to God is that we can then call on him. He will deliver us in times of need. Over in Psalm 116 in verse 14, it says the same thing, only in slightly different words, that we are required to pay our vows to God. There is no justification for not doing so. There's justification in the Bible in three different ways. Most of you probably heard those. You could probably recite them. There's justification by law. The Pharisees tried that. They were going to earn their way to salvation. There's justification by grace. The Apostle Paul taught that in Romans. We are saved by grace. We are saved by God's forgiveness. But there's a third justification that we are all too familiar with, and we try it oh so often. It's called justification by the sins of others. Remember Adam? What did Adam say to God? That woman that you gave me, she made me do it. Or what Eve said to God, well, that snake, you know, he seduced me. It's his fault. He told me lies. Too often in a marriage, when we sit down for marriage counseling, we find justification by the sins of the other one as the common topic of conversation. And it is absolutely unscriptural. It's wrong. The fruits are always bad, and it leads nowhere. Psalm 116 and verse 14 says, I will pay my vows to the Lord in the presence of all his people. Interesting that marriage vows are made in the presence of all of those assembled there. And also in verse 18 says the same thing if you drop down to verse 18 in Psalm 116. I'll pay my vows to the Lord in the presence of all his people. The last part of the marriage ceremony, if you remember, probably do because most of us have been to many of these, says, because marriage is a divine institution, we are asking God to join you as husband and wife. And it is fitting and right that each of you should faithfully promise before God to accept the sacred marriage covenant according to the divinely ordained conditions established by Almighty God. So we have this part of the ceremony that twice more acknowledges that God is the third party, that we are making a covenant not just with the one that we love and are anxious to spend the rest of our life with, and of all these dreams of accomplishing wonderful things, but also with the God who wants us to be with him in his kingdom forever. So we offer to God our thanksgiving, and we agree as we walk down the aisle, and we've seen it so many times, that these two are going to have challenges in life. I think in the church we have, rightfully so, sort of a high idealistic expectations quotient. That's one of the categories that we go through when doing marriage counseling, and we use the Prepare and Rich profile. These idealistic expectations are supposed to measure how unrealistic the couple is with the fact that they dream they'll be perfect, there'll be no trouble, that there'll be wedded bliss, that once they head off into the sunset on the white horse, it'll be happiness and good times forever. And it's amazing that the couples in the Church of God, since the 20-some years I've been using those profiles, score higher than almost any other group that we know of or that Prepare and Rich knows of in idealistic expectations. Now, in one sense, that's a challenge. We want people to be realistic about the challenges of life and the fact that things don't always work out perfectly well. But on the other hand, expectations tend to sometimes actually come to pass. Remember that old song, "My Future is So Bright, I've Got to Wear Shades"? This is a guy who's a little overconfident about his future. Well, in some cases, though, just expecting things to be great and just knowing it's going to work out well tends to make the result sort of work out that way. Not that it's always perfect, but expecting an outcome sometimes helps that outcome to be there. And so we do have some very positive, anxious couples who are looking forward to spending their life together and following in the footsteps of so many other very successful and wonderful couples in the Church of God, because we have had so many good examples and so many who have been building blocks of society and of the church as God intended. But when there is trouble in a marriage, it's the result of people violating their covenant with God. Let's talk about some specifics. What does it mean, the marriage covenant that we have made with God? Let's go over to Ephesians 5 and verse 23. I won't spend a great deal of time here because Mr. Reeves covered it quite a bit last week. But the important thing for men to realize is that we have a job description. The women do too. In fact, the women have an example to follow. They have actually a name of a person they can emulate. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 23. See, it says, "The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." And then in verse 25, we get the covenant that husbands have made with God. "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her." So man's responsibility is a tall order. We are to love our wives as Jesus Christ loves the church. Now, how does Jesus Christ treat us as his church? How often does he lose his temper and yell at us? How often does he neglect the responsibility of being the head of the house? How often does he flirt with other people that are not part of the relationship? Well, the answer is none. Let's go over to John chapter 14, where Christ described what he would be doing as the husband in waiting, because he's very anxious to return to this earth and to have the wedding supper and have the bride of Christ presented to him. As the Apostle Paul said, he was anxious to present them as a chaste bride to Christ. So he is waiting for that ceremony to be finished and the life together to be begun. So in the meantime, he's conducting himself as a covenanted, as a husband who is betrothed, legally married to, but not yet living with his bride. John chapter 14 and verse 27 says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you." So Jesus Christ said he would give us peace. A husband needs to strive to create an atmosphere of peace in his family. People like, or women like, their home. They like their nests, as they say, their nest builders. They don't like being moved all the time. But sometimes you women just have to do it. You just have to follow your husbands. My wife and I were married. I'm not sure how many places we lived. I worked for the Worldwide Church of God for 13 years, and in those 13 years, we moved 14 times. Lived in 15 different houses. Not every time between church areas, only about five of them were between church areas. We were told we could never buy, we had to rent. And so twice our landlords didn't make the payment, and the guy showed up at the door to kick us out, and he said, well, it's not our house, we're renting it. Well, yeah, but I'm XYZ mortgage company, you're being evicted, you got 3 days. I said, wait a minute, I got proof I paid rent. So, of course, they win the argument, you have to move. We had some other issues, but basically, if moving was cause for divorce, I would be a single man. But my wife, who grew up in one house and one farm, and then married me and lived like a grasshopper for the next 15 years, bouncing from house to house, she could have said, I've had it, but she didn't. And so I've tried ever since we have changed circumstances in our life to provide her a nice home and hopefully not moving too often. But men need to understand that we need to create peace. We need not to cause discord or uncertainty. Wives and children need stability in the family. Jesus Christ gives us stability. He's not leaving us alone. He gives us support. He's always there to listen. If there is a thread of commonality among the divorces that I have been a part of trying to prevent or to counsel against over the past 15 years, the internet pornography issue has come up several times, obviously, as it has nationwide caused so much damage. But the one that has surprised me, I believe, has been the lack of temper control among the husbands, that there has been just way, way too often reports of young men yelling and screaming and going off. And that was more common in previous years among wives. Not that it's godly or good, righteous, justified, or permissible in either one. There's the old saying that yelling is not child-rearing. Yelling is what you do when you don't know how to rear children. That's true, by the way. It's also true with being husbands and wives. Yelling is what you do when you don't know what else to do because you simply have let yourself run out of control. And we could spend lots of time talking about self-control and controlling our spirit as a way of obeying our covenant with God. And perhaps we'll have time to mention it in future times. But the important thing here in John is that Jesus Christ said he left us with peace. What a wonderful thing in a world of turmoil to know we can always go on our knees or to our Bible and have peace returned to us. And if men are to love their wives and their children as Christ loved the church, one of our goals is to create an atmosphere of peace. In the next chapter, John 15, and verse 4, it says, abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. So there is a togetherness that is necessary. When they are married, it means they should live together. There's been far too much separation for job or other reasons among couples in many years. And I know that the 1 year, or actually about 5 months, where I was out of town every other week during our marriage, it was not easy, very, very challenging, very difficult for all of us. And we simply said we would never do that again, and we made sure we didn't. But the year 1995 was a year none of us want to repeat. And with God's mercy, we won't ever have to. Verse 5 says, I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. In a application to marriage, if a husband and wife abide with each other and do well, they'll produce much fruit. Not only beautiful children or a beautiful relationship, they can serve in the church. They can produce many good things that benefit themselves and many others. But the key is to abide in each other and to make sure those lines of communication stay open and that there is no open warfare or damage. Verse 7, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire and it shall be done for you. That by this, my Father is glorified that you bear much fruit. And so we are to bear spiritual fruit to God, and part of that, of course, part of the result of that or the cause of that are marriages that reflect Jesus Christ in the church, as it says in the last part of Ephesians chapter 5. Let's go back over to John chapter 10. Jesus Christ, in this incredibly beautiful chapter about the Good Shepherd, describes himself as taking care of the sheep. What if every husband in the Church of God would read this on a regular basis as a guideline as to how he ought to be a husband and treat his wife and children? What changes there might be. John chapter 10 and verse 11 says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. In other words, what's important when he's out there is the health and the welfare of the sheep, not going to the pool hall and playing pool with the boys, not just going down playing video games. But this shepherd is very concerned about taking care of the needs of his sheep. Verse 15 says, as the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. In other words, he provides, he protects. He is there always. He lays down his life. His purpose is to protect and take care of that family. So that's the job description of the husband in the Bible. We could add many more verses to that. But now I want to look at a couple of verses that we often use in premarital and in marriage counseling. For a number of years when I was first hired as a minister in the church, I was somewhat frustrated in the marriage counseling issue because back in the worldwide days in the early middle 80s, we had sort of the first run of a lot of divorces and broken families. And it was frustrating visiting with the men I was working with because oftentimes we would have the same conversation every month. It seemed like we were not making any headway, that the couples were where they were. You know, they would have a fight, then they would have us come over in a few days, and they would calm down and make a commitment, things are going to be better. And then a week, 2 weeks, a month later, it was the same thing. So I decided I wanted to have sort of a linear progression and to have some milestones for improvements in the counseling process so that I wasn't wasting my time and they were not deceiving themselves, thinking things were going to be better when we all knew they weren't, just based on track record. So I put some marriage sheets together where I went through all of the commands that God has for husbands. And then the homework assignment, of course, is to write the verse out. And the next column is how I have or have not been obeying God's commands, because all marriage problems are disobeying God's commands in one form or another. And the same with the wives and the way the marriage sheets are put together. They begin with some physical things, and then they progress to some more spiritual analysis. The first, and I've had dozens of other pastors around the country who have requested those, and I've given them to many, many others who have used them. I've trained Mr. Reeves in how to use them and also some others, so there's not a big secret. The first verse of self-analysis for both husbands and wives in the sheets I put together and have used for about 20 years is Proverbs chapter 5, beginning in verse 15. Proverbs chapter 5, beginning in verse 15. It's such an important concept. If this is violated, there's no use going any farther. Because if there's a third person or somehow an intruder into the marriage covenant, then there really is any doubt. There's no, why go any farther into talking about 1 Corinthians 13 and the specifics about how to love each other? If this is violated, there really is no more to be said. In Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15 says, drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. He goes on very soon to say what he's talking about is your wife and your husband. He's not talking about water. He's not talking about fountains. He's talking about cleaving as you promised you would to your husband or your wife. And this is focused on the man here, but the principle is the same for both. It said, should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. So your romantic interests, your attraction to members of the opposite sex is for your spouse only. Very simple. Let them be only your own. And the responsibility for that is you. Nobody else can do it for you. Nobody else can control your eyes or your thoughts. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. And the wife of your youth, if you properly rejoice in 30, 40, 50, 60 years, you'll still be rejoicing. And there really is nothing more I think that can bring happiness to a person's life than that. I've got some little habits or quirks. One is that I collect some certain stories that I read in the news. I have a file of these stories. These are stories of couples who've been married many, many years, 50, 60 or more years, that die the same day. It's amazing. I mean, I've got like 12 of these. This is just one of them. This is one of the more recent ones. Quarterback Doug Flutie's parents died within 1 hour of each other. Doug Flutie and his family had the kind of tragic day you could never imagine. Well, tragic, yes, but wonderful, too. According to a post on Flutie's Facebook page, his father, Dick, died of a heart attack in the hospital Wednesday morning. Less than an hour later, his mother, Joan, died of a sudden heart attack. Flutie's parents were married for 56 years. They can say you die of a broken heart, and I believe it, Doug Flutie wrote. Flutie wrote that his father had been ill before the heart attack. He honored them on his Facebook post. I would like to honor my parents for all they did throughout my life, for me and my brothers and my sisters. My parents were always there for their children from the days my dad coached us as kids and my mom would work the concession stands through this morning. The most important part of their 56 years of marriage was providing opportunities for their children. They were incredible parents and grandparents, and my family and I will miss them both. So many of these couples that live so many years just don't seem to have a reason to live after the one that they've loved so much dies. And so perhaps because of that, we have these couples that die the same day or next to the same day or very, very close. My wife and I have joked that we really need to die the same day and just be buried in one casket. They can just stuff both of us in there and save money and save, you know, funeral arrangements, time and all of that. But it is a wonderful thing when a couple gets married and they have a life that is essentially a 50 or 60 or 70 year long honeymoon. That's only possible if there are no intruders into your marriage. It says in verse 19, as a loving doe or deer and graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times, always be enraptured with her love. Love should always grow, it should not diminish. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman or embraced in the arms of a seductress? We all know how that happens with a man. We're all very familiar with the things that have gone on over the years with, the pornographic industry and some of the other things that are out there. Sometimes we don't think about how it happens with women, because wives also need to build a fence around their marriage and not allow thoughts of adultery, thoughts of other men, thoughts of wondering whatever to come into them. They should be simply building that fence just like the man has to. Number one genre of books sold in this country are romance novels. Romance novels total in the billions every year. They are roughly one-fifth of all adult fiction sales. The average romance novel reader reads one a week. They are voracious readers. Romance readers average between 30 and 54 in age. Most are college educated. They're higher on the income status than normal. 59% are married. Almost 85% are women. It is not men that are buying all these romance novels and then vicariously enjoying the experiences that are contained therein. With men, it's with their eyes. With women, it is with their minds, where they fantasize. Well, I went to the movie, and Robert Redford and this girl, you know, he saved her, and they took off, and life was perfect. And, you know, Paul Newman, and I'm not sure who the new ones are because I'm not there. Maybe it was Tom Hanks or whatever. And they think that they're going to marry this Claude who's just like this movie star. Well, the truth of the matter is the movie stars are Claudes, too. You just don't know them very well. Let's go over to Titus chapter 2 and verse 6. So often, though, it is that a woman can be in love with the idea of romance, with the idea of being romanced, with the idea of, you know, how wonderful it's going to be when Prince Charming comes home every night. You know, the thought of piles of dirty laundry and crying babies and dirty diapers and unpaid bills and the bill collectors calling and the car breaking down and all those other things that happen, that's not normally in the picture of the way things are going to be before they get married. But it is part of real life for most of us. Most of us have enjoyed those days and gone through it. And honestly, if you face all of those problems together, then you're bonded closer together. And it just simply is not something that will cause any trouble. But certainly, in our society, there are those temptations for the men and also for the women. And the proverb says we must build a wall around that relationship. If there are only two people in the marriage, in the relationship, there's always hope. When there is a third person, that chance for recovery and rebuilding that marriage is almost down to zero. Titus chapter 2, let's look at verse 6. Likewise, the young men should be sober-minded. Now, this is after some admonishments to the women that we'll read a little bit later. Verse 7 says, in all things show yourself a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, speech that cannot be condemned. It's interesting, the young women that are addressed earlier are told they should get married and have children. So these young men are the same age category. I would guess these guys were in their late teens, early 20s. In that society, age 50 was old. So they're probably, young adults by our standards. What are they supposed to do? Doesn't say play video games. Doesn't say waste time. Doesn't say, go down and drink all the time. It says exactly the opposite. It says be sober-minded in all things, showing yourself a pattern of good works, showing integrity, reverence, and incorruptibility. Now, why is that? Because that's the kind of young man a young girl wants to marry. And that's the kind of young man that makes a good husband and a good father. Someone that is showing good works, accomplishing things with his life, showing integrity. He doesn't lie to her. He doesn't deceive. He doesn't cheat. I have a book called Avoiding Mr. Wrong by Stephen Arterburn. It has seven categories of young men that women ought to avoid. I bought two copies, one for both of my daughters. One daughter read it, the other laughed at it, wouldn't read it. But anyway, one of the categories is the liar. Young man lies to you, walk away. That's a good door-shutting indication that his character is flawed. This is what young men ought to do. And these are things we teach at camp, and we certainly want our young men to grow up to have these. Integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, a pattern of good works. That is what will cause you to have good relationships and successful marriages later in life. Now let's briefly talk about what is the covenant that God makes with wives. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 3. So when a wife, a young lady, is a bride and then says, I do, commits herself in a covenant with God and this young man, and she's now a wife, what is the covenant she has made with God? 1 Peter chapter 3 says, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands. That's in verse 1. That even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. Now, we look at this always in the context of being married to somebody who's unmarried, unconverted. So Susie Smith is married to some guy named Joe, and he's not in the church, and she is. But how about if they're both baptized, converted members, but just not perfect yet? And that the husband who might have some problems and flaws might be well served by a wife who's a good example. And he might come around and thinking, you know what, I haven't been doing what a Christian young man ought to. My wife's a great example. So think about this verse, at least for a minute, about two married people. Because I've got a big, big, big secret to tell you. Don't pass this on because this is private knowledge, okay? There's only one perfect man who ever lived, and he's not married yet. So all the rest of you women are condemned to marrying us flawed clods. That's it. We're imperfect. We're always going to be. We're going to have issues. We're going to do things that aren't right. Why then does God say you are to follow Sarah? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Let's continue. So the only perfect person who ever lived isn't married yet, and all the rest of you are married to us imperfect persons. Verse 2, but when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, it's beneficial. Be a good example is what he's saying, not a good criticizer. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging of the hair, wearing of gold, or putting on fine apparel, very common in the Roman Empire, where the women were trying to impress each other with their clothes and decorations, hairstyles, jewelry. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Oftentimes in counseling, we will ask the bride-to-be or the frustrated wife, what does it mean to you to have a gentle and quiet spirit? And oftentimes there's sort of a long pause and a deer in the headlights look because they've never given it much thought. So let me encourage all the young ladies and other ladies in the audience who might hear this, at least give a few seconds thought to what it means to have a gentle and quiet spirit, because God says it is of a very precious thing to him. In this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves. They adorned themselves with a meek and quiet spirit, not hair of plated gold, being submissive to their own husbands. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Now, I want to ask you a question. Was Abraham perfect? Let's go over to Genesis chapter 12. Since your covenant with God as a wife is to follow the example of Sarah, perhaps it's beneficial to look at the life of Sarah. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. The Lord has said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. I'll curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. We are introduced to Abraham and the word of God in chapter 12 as one who would be blessing to all the earth. So Abraham departed. As the Lord had spoken with him, Lot went with him, his nephew. He was 75 years old when he left Haran, and he took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions, all they had gathered, and the people who they had acquired in Haran, and they parted to go into the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan, but it says in verse 4, the Canaanites were there in this land. Now, what Sarah could have done, he said, listen, Abraham, we have a nice house. This is like a palace. We got running water, got roof over my head. You know, we got animals outside not living in the tent with us. And now you, husband, want me to go live in a tent out in the desert with those evil Canaanites, idol worshipers. Who do you think you are? Is that what Sarah said? No. There Sarah went. She went with her husband. She didn't criticize a husband who would keep her in a tent for the rest of her life, living on somebody else's land. And when she died, they had to buy a cave from the sons of Heth as a place to bury her. So she lived, just like Abraham, without a house for the rest of her life. Now it got worse. Verse 9, Abraham journeyed, was still going south. There was a famine in the land, so he went down to Egypt. It came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarah, his wife, indeed I know you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Flattery is always a good thing when you want a person to do something. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you, they'll say, this is my wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. So please say you're my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live. Now, what he should have said was, God promised he would take care of us. The eternal God promised we would be the parents of a great blessing of many nations and a great blessing for the rest of the earth. So we're going to go to Egypt and just trust God to take care of us. It's not what Abraham said, was it? Abraham was at this point weak in the faith. So what did Sarah do? She said, who do you think you are? Give me over to the Egyptians. You dirty, rotten scum of a husband. You don't care about me. Just care about yourself. If you're concerned about my health and what's good for me, you wouldn't be doing this. We wouldn't be going down to Egypt. I'm just kidding. She didn't say that, but I'm just sort of paraphrasing some conversations I've heard over the years. So it worked out okay, even though she did spend some time as a prisoner, so to speak, in the land of Egypt. Let's go over to chapter 13 and verse 1. Abraham went up from Egypt, he and his wife, all that he has. They came back from Egypt. He was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. And he was sharing some land with Lot, his nephew. Verse 5. Verse 6, the Lamb was not able to support them that they might dwell together. Their possessions were so great they could not dwell together, and there was strife between the herdsmen, Abraham's livestock, and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. And the Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. So Abraham said to Lot, that's his nephew, please let there be no strife between me and you, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, because we're brethren. Is not the whole land before me? Please separate from me. If you take the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, then I'll go to the left. So Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan and saw that it was well watered. Lots of grass, lots of great places to have livestock. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed there, and they separated from each other. It doesn't say, but I'm going to assume that when Abraham came back to the tent and Sarah found out, she says, man, you are a terrible businessman. Who do you think you are giving the good land to your little nephew? You are older. You have a right to the good land. Tell him to go out in the desert. We're going to be scraping by here in this old hard scrabble, hot dust and sand and hardly anything for our animals to eat. And you are just a rotten business deal. I should have married a husband who had better business sense than you. Any of you wives have husbands who have lost money in bad business deals? No, do not raise your hand. Well, if we were all honest about it, everybody has made some bad business deals. Most wives take it in stride because they realize the only perfect man isn't married yet, and they're married to a guy that might have been trying. Doesn't say Sarah said that, does it? It's an indication that she continued to support her husband. I remember one couple down in Oregon years ago when I was first hired to the ministry called me over, and the wife was just livid because her husband had taken most of her life savings and bought a dump truck, and he was going to start this trucking business. He'd been laid off from his job. And lo and behold, after a month or so of driving with his dump truck and trying to establish some clients and make some money with it, the engine blew up, and there was no insurance, of course, on the engine. And so this lady was just hotter than a pistol because now they were out of money, and her husband had spent it all in this dump truck, and the dump truck had blown up, and they were in this real fix. And he just hung his head and wanted to cry because she just went on and on and on and on. I felt so sorry for him. And I finally looked at her and I said, you know what? He was sincerely trying to do what he thought was right for you and his family. He was trying to work. I said, please don't beat up on him anymore. He doesn't deserve it. He was trying. If not his fault, he simply spent the money on a business that was going to be good. He knows how to drive a truck. And all you're doing is making it worse by beating up on this poor man and just criticizing him over and over. Well, that's what she did. And I'm not sure how it ever turned out. But she was only hurting herself and hurting her family. And every wise woman builds her house. And there's nothing to be accomplished by tearing it down. Part of these issues are caused by modern-day feminism. I think I've had enough time to read a couple excerpts here from a book. This is The Proper Care and Feeding of Marriage by Dr. Laura Schlesinger. I know she's no longer on the radio, but she does have a good library of books that she wrote. Unfortunately, the curse of feminism has bled into members of the Church of God and has affected the attitudes of many of our husbands and wives. She says, how could it be that several generations of women don't appreciate the value and power of their femininity? How is it that women could yearn to throw away their magnificent importance as the center of family, community, and life itself? The answer is feminism. Feminism has been a scourge upon the land and upon women, children, men, and ultimately families and society. The true ideal of feminism, that men and women should have the same rights and opportunities, is an obvious positive civil rights issue, but that is not the feminism that we are dominated with. The feminism movement, as such, was totally co-opted by a mentality that despised femininity, motherhood, wifehood, and men in all forms except castrated. Quote, this is a caller. I am married to a feminist psychology professor. Envy me. My life under the feminist Taliban has taken a mixture of guilt mixed with hopelessness and despair. I have been less than a plow horse. To be a man was to be blamed for everything, appreciated for nothing. Rescuing her and her siblings' lives, buying her a 4,000-square-foot, 6-bedroom house on a hill was only to be expected. I started listening to you on your show to be better understanding my wife and her career. Instead, I ended up understanding myself. I saw me now that I have value. My needs and feelings are not scummy. I'm no longer devastated by her displeasure. And so she simply goes on and talks about the issue that feminism has done to so many families in our land. I want to continue on. Let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 33. You know, if something is mentioned twice in the Bible, it's important. It's in the mouth of two witnesses that a thing is established as true. And so if twice in the Bible God says this is what it is, then we should take notice. In 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 33, very simple statement. Sometimes there are parenthetical statements that are accepted truths in the Bible. They're not declarative statements, but they are there and they have the power of declarative statements because they are in the Word of God, inspired by God, and they are there as accepted truths that we all ought to acknowledge and understand. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 33 says, "He who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife." So a husband, in this sort of observational statement, his job is to try to please his wife. Verse 34, "There's a difference between a virgin and a wife. An unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband." You see, the big problem with modern day femininity, and in fact with most of the, I might say, marriage advice you would get on TED Talks and other places, is that you are in it for your own self-fulfillment. You're in it for your needs. The wife is there because he's going to make her happy, and he is there because she's going to make him happy and take care of certain things, and she'll take care of certain things for him. But there is this selfish approach that goes into the marriage covenant, the marriage agreement, so often, and because of that, it is no surprise that our divorce rates are so high and so many are choosing simply to cohabit and live in adultery or fornication rather than get married and do it God's way. So a married man focuses on pleasing his wife, and a married woman should focus on how to please her husband. She cares about the things of the world and how to please her husband. Let's go over to Titus chapter 2, where it is said again. Titus chapter 2, it is said again that the important job of a wife, their focus is how to please their husband. And so oftentimes these are ignored. It says Titus chapter 2 and verse 1 says, "As for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine." That's Paul speaking to Titus. "That the older men should be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience. The older women likewise, they should be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things." They should protect their family, make sure it is surrounded by their wall of protection. They don't slander or say anything bad about their family members to others. Verse 4, "They admonish the young women to love their husbands and to love their children." So again, the young women are to love their husbands, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Very important list of things that young women are to be admonished to do, to love their husbands, love their children, to be discreet in what they say, to be chaste, not to be allowing any of those experiences or things out of their home, out of their relationship with their husband. Homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands. I think we do a pretty good job overall in the church of teaching our young ladies how to be homemakers. It's amazing how few young girls today grow up understanding anything about being a homemaker. When our daughters were in sports, we would often have the volleyball team or the basketball team over and make homemade pizza. And there were girls who were 16, 17 years old that did not know you could grate cheese. They thought you had to buy the grated cheese in a bag. And so my wife gave them a block of cheese and a grater, and they didn't know what to do with it. What do you do with this? They didn't know you could make bread. They didn't know how to make dough or wheat or let bread rise or anything. They didn't know anything other than pizza came in a cardboard box after somebody outside honked his horn. delivered it to you. And so many of those things, the world simply has forgotten. I think we do a much better job, and I'm proud to say that we have a lot of young ladies that are learning how to be homemakers, and certainly the prospect of a good homemade food, homemade meal is a good thing. It makes a husband appreciate his wife. If everything comes out of a can or a box or goes into a microwave, it just isn't quite the same. So I don't want to brag too much about my wife. I don't want her to throw things at me, but she's really good at killing chickens, and we raise a lot of chickens, and we have our own organic chickens, and they taste really good, and she's super good at making salsa. We have salsa-making parties. We've done as many as 200 quarts in one day with big bushel baskets of tomatoes and jalapenos, and the kitchen is a big mess, and all kinds of people come over and help. But I have been very well rewarded as a husband to have a wife who grew up on a farm and knows how to cook, knows how to grow a garden, knows how to do things. In fact, after you get married, sometimes you have this aha moment, like, aha, oh, I'm so glad I married her, or aha, I wish I hadn't married her. This is a true story. The first deer I killed after we got married, we'll have been married about a year. We got married in August, it would have been the next fall, maybe a year and 2 months. We were in eastern Washington hunting on the Waitsburg watershed, and I had a short-range gun. I wasn't a very good shot back then, and I finally got a deer, hung this deer up in this tree, and I go back to the car to get my knife. It had been gutted, but it was still we were going to skin it. So I went back to the pickup and got back to the deer, and on the way back, I saw the deer was about 3/4 skinned. And this lovely girl I'd married had borrowed a knife from one of the other hunters and had skinned my deer. I thought, man, I have scored. You could not imagine. This is so cool. Marry a girl who already knows how to skin a deer. I mean, this is just wonderful. So that was one of those aha moments. Like, aha, this is it. This is wonderful. And I'm sure all of you husbands could tell similar stories. But being keepers at home is not an option. It's a commandment from God. It's a role description. And learning how to be chaste and discreet and how to be just, quote, good, a good person. Those are all directives from God that cannot be obeyed. Let's go over to Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 1. Proverbs 14 and verse 1. This is another verse that we use often in marriage counseling. We used to have a saying in the ministry, I'm not sure if it was nationwide or just in the church areas where I was, that divorces always happen in pairs. Because what normally would happen is a woman would have whatever issues, and she would find some soulmate in the church who also had marriage issues. Before long, they would get together and have pity parties. And Mary would pity Sue and say, my husband's this way, he does that. Well, my husband's this way, he does that too. Well, does yours do this? Yeah, mine does that too. And before long, we didn't have one divorce. We had two going on. And I remember as a minister telling two women they could no longer even talk to each other because it was always slander about each other's husbands. In Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 1, it says, the wise woman builds her house. Now, does that mean she gets out 2x4s and 2x6s and mixes concrete? No, not physically speaking. A wise woman builds her house by teaching, by encouraging, by being a part of every good thing that happens in their life, and by just building the relationships in the house. A wise woman, a wife, is the one who is the core of the relationship that holds the family together and is constantly making contact with, you know, the extended family, brothers, sisters, children, grandchildren, and building the house, you know, the family unit. A wise woman builds her house. She does not tear it down. She does not complain. She does not tear down her husband. She does not tear down her children. She builds them up and tries to make them all a successful unit working together. In Dr. Laura's book here on page 86, there's a little quote I want to read. The writer says that I have this immense power to either ruin my husband and my children's lives or enrich them. If I decide to disrespect my husband, then my children will disrespect their father as well. My mood and to what degree I allow that mood to dictate my behavior has a direct result on everyone else's mood, and therefore their daily lives. Amazing and scary and so very humbling. So that's a lady who wrote in to Dr. Laura who understood that a wise woman would build her house because the woman has the ability to be the glue, to be the bonding agent between everybody in the house. Now, what is the Bible standard? Let's go to Proverbs chapter 31. First, I want to read a couple items I got off the internet. If you do some searching, you'll find some interesting things. Here's top 10 reasons for divorce. If you were to Google reasons for divorce, you'll find them all over the map. I thought this one said something I've never seen before. And delving into the subject off and on for 40 years, I've never seen this one before. This is from a writer called Shannon Johnson. She has her own webpage on marriage. Top 10 reasons couples divorce. Number one is extramarital affairs. And I think we all understand how that works. The second one she has is weight gain. She talks about the massive obesity problem we have in this country, where about 40 to 60% of adults end up very overweight. And it isn't just a matter of looks, it's a matter of health. It's a matter of being able to have stamina and energetic and enjoy life. And she says that is often very, very, in her experience anyway, in her clinic, it's the second most quoted reason for couples divorcing. And of course, there's money. And the money management or money choices issues, lack of communication, we all understand that. And then abuse of various kinds, which of course includes addiction and other ways that a family can be abused. This one says, who are the happiest wives in America? It says, according to the news report of the University of Virginia's National Marriage Project, the surprising answer is women who attend church every week with their husbands and have four or more children. So they mentioned here women like Mrs. Romney and Mrs. Santorum, they were political figures' wives. Says this site is embedded in a larger report whose overall purpose is to find out the factors that lead to happy and successful married families. We found that a pronatalistic attitude, which means wanting to have children, is one of the top five predictors of marital happiness for both wives and husbands. Religious commitment also helps to build happy marriages for women. Here actions speak even louder than words. Only when husbands and wives both attend church regularly are wives more likely to be very happily married. 64% of wives report being very happy when they and their husbands attend church regularly, compared with about 50% of wives in a marriage where only one spouse goes to church. Wives in marriages where both spouses go to church regularly are also about one-third as likely to report their marriage is at risk for divorce. 77% of wives in marriages where both husband and wife believe God is the center of my marriage, report being happy, and just 1% report any thought of divorce. Should read that again. 77% of wives in marriages where both husband and wife believe God is the center of my marriage, report being very happy, and barely 1% are harboring any thoughts of ever getting divorced. So God knew what he was talking about when he said, you covenant with me in this marriage, because the third party is very, very important. Now we're going to go to the bad and the good. Now, wait a minute. This is the good and the good. Okay. Five things every man loves to hear. This is my favorite thing to read on the internet. It was one of my most unusual moments. My husband and I were driving home from a trip. This is, by the way, from HelloReds@gmail.com. I don't have the author's name here, but it's a website. I decided to pose a question to my husband about one of my upcoming blogs. I asked, honey, I'm writing an article entitled Five Things That Every Husband Loves to Hear. Do you have any suggestions? My husband did not blink. He did not stammer. He did not pause. He did not take a breath. He immediately gave me a list of five things he loves to hear and would love to hear more often. I had to write as fast as I could to keep up with him. Some of you ladies ought to try this with your husbands. Number one, I respect you as a man, as a person, as a dad, as a husband. I respect and admire you. What was Ephesians 5 say that husbands, wives are to respect their husbands? Number two, I appreciate you as a man. I appreciate you and who you are as a man of integrity. I'm so grateful for who you are. I'm thankful to be your wife and girlfriend. Of course, there are marriages that both apply. Number three, I appreciate what you do. Number four, I love you. We like to hear it just like the women do. And number five, I would choose you all over if I could do it again. I had a thought about that a few weeks ago. My son was over. He likes my old tractor I bought. He likes to come over and mow the pasture, so I got this mower, and he's out there mowing. But he comes to my office, and I've got this picture of my bride when she was 18 on my computer. He said, "Who was that? Is that Mom?" I said, "Yeah, that's your mom when she was 18. He said, "Man, she was cute." And I said, "Yep, there's reasons why lots of other guys proposed to her, but she had to wait until she met me." But he couldn't believe how cute and pretty his mom was when she was 18, because now she's a few years older, and, you know, he's a few years older. 10 things a hurting husband needs from his wife. You know, women are emotional creatures. We all agree on that. But the sad truth is, men are too. And when men are hurting because they have been through a bad business deal, they've lost their job, or something's not going well, oftentimes they hide. They won't say anything because they're afraid of getting verbally beaten up. 10 things your husband needs to hear when he's hurting. He needs your encouragement, not his rejection. He needs you to forgive him his failures and wrong choices. He needs you to believe in him. He needs you to pray for him. He needs you to be his friend and his lover. Women all often remove the second as a mode of punishment. They think it's justified. The Bible says exactly the opposite, 1 Corinthians 7. He needs you to love him for who he is and where he's at. He needs you to focus on your growth and help him also to grow. He needs you to take care of him. When my beloved was broken, I made it my aim to build him up and speak the words of life to him as often as I could. When your man is down, it is easy for a wife just to take over. But do not take this path. If your man feels emasculated by your leadership, he will withdraw even more. Then it says 99 ways to show your husband respect. I don't have time for 99 ways. But here's a good one. Stop what you are doing and look at him when he talks. That probably applies to both husbands and wives. Refrain from interrupting him when he's talking. Pray with him, pray for him. Tell him something you admire about him. Talk positively to him about others. There may not be anything more hurtful than for a husband or wife to either overhear or hear that their spouse has said something harmful or critical to other people. That's not building a wall around your marriage. That's building, tearing the wall down. Give him space if he's in the house. Ask him, "What can I do for him today?" Give him a kiss when he walks out the door in the morning. Remember the old Father Knows Best movies and Leave It to Beaver? There are a few other things here I won't read because this isn't a marriage seminar, but I think you could probably assume what they are. Give him space and time to understand his hobbies. Focus on what he's doing right. Speak honorably about him and to him in front of the children. There are many others, but I think that's all we have. Today I want to end on Proverbs 31. You might have assumed we were going to go there. But Proverbs 31 isn't just about the perfect wife. It's also a chapter for the husbands. Because this is a couple that has achieved what God says will cause them to be praised by others. The man and woman have both left their family. Remember when Jesus Christ said that in the very beginning God made them male and female, and for this cause a man shall leave his mother and father and cleave unto his wife, and the two of them become one unit. Sometimes we don't obey that very well. Often it's the parents. When I go to a wedding or perform a wedding, and one of the mothers-in-law comes up and says, "Oh, I feel like I'm not losing a son. I'm just gaining a daughter." I say, no, you're wrong. You're losing a son. Because he has his own family now. He has his own wife. He doesn't need mom anymore like he used to. Same thing with mothers who say, "Oh, I'm not losing a daughter. I'm just gaining a son." No, you're losing a daughter. She's now her husband's wife. And we still have parents who don't understand that Jesus Christ said, "Leave." Doesn't mean stay out of communication, but it's a new family unit has to be formed. When I was in Oregon, there was a man there, been married for years, had a wife and kids. He got off work every day at 4 o'clock and went to his mother's house and for 1 hour had tea with his mother and then went home to see his wife and kids. Been doing that for 20 some years. And I looked at him, I said, "You are stealing an hour's worth of time from your wife and your kids every single day. It's wrong. yeah, but, you know, I love my mother. She's been nice to us. And she, truth of the matter was, mother was pressuring him, probably threatening or extortioning him, whatever. I don't know how many times you hear about mothers who will call their married son 3, 4, 5 times a day, 10 times a week, whatever. They won't let him bond with the wife he has because, whatever, insecurity on their part, whatever it might be. I hear about it across the country from time to time. Truth of the matter is, you want your son to bond with his wife. You want your wife to bond with her new husband. And you want them to share those thoughts. You don't want dad calling their daughter every 5 or 10, 15 minutes. I've seen what a oppressive, controlling father can do to a marriage of a young girl who's only been married a few months. And essentially, it's not good. You have to turn loose. There's that old song about flowers in her hair, but you really do have to turn loose and give her away and let her and her husband make their own family in the world. And the husband and wife the same way. And I think when I first got married, I was getting married over in Pasco, I had a minor, it wasn't a really good job offer, but I was looking at working up in Moses Lake where my in-laws lived, and the minister, I was just driving in the car with him, we were going to church in Yakima, I think. He looked at me and he said, 100 miles. You got to remember the 100 mile rule. And I said, what is that? He said, you need to live 100 miles away from her parents. Because I know all four of you and you need to live 100 miles away from her parents. So you need to move somewhere else. And you know what? He was right. And with my family, we had the 2,000 mile rule. My wife said, we're not going to live any closer than 2,000 miles to any of your family. And so both those rules have kept us in good stead. But even if you're living in the same city or proximity, give your kids the chance to grow up. Let them become adults. You want them to raise adults, not perpetual children. Now let's go back to Proverbs 31. In this incredible chapter that says so much, he says in verse 10, who can find a virtuous wife? Her worth is far above rubies. It is far more valuable to find a virtuous wife than to have millions of dollars and to win the lottery. How many supposedly rich people would have given all they have for one good marriage, one wonderful wife to live with? Notice the heart of her husband safely trusts her. Trust is so important. A husband can violate trust, but a wife can too. If he trusts that she will treat him well no matter what he does in the sense of having a bad business deal or perhaps he makes mistakes or doesn't provide as much as she thinks or whatever it might be, but a husband trusting that his wife will not become a sharp-tongued razor is vital. It's very important. There are two proverbs about living on a housetop instead of near a brawling woman. But the woman also has to be able to trust her husband, that he will not be out doing things that he should not, that he will be just like Jesus Christ is to the church with every bit of his effort and possibilities. She will have no lack of gain. He'll provide for her. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. What a wonderful world we would have if all wives and husbands did each other good and not evil all the days of their life. Then there are several verses on how hard she works. She seeks wool and flax. She makes clothes. She rises while it is yet night in verse 15, probably the least favorite scripture in the Bible for most women. They don't want to get up early. They want to sleep in. That's a joke, by the way, but a lot of them do get up early. But I know that the girls I have lived with and around like to sleep in. My daughters, my wife, where I like to get up around 5:30 in the morning, and my eyes are open staring at the ceiling. I got to get up. I just can't sleep any longer. She rises while it is night, provides food for her household, portions for her servants. She buys fields. She plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength. She perceives that her merchandise is good. So she's very competent. She's hardworking. She does everything for the good of her family. She extends her hand to the poor. She's able to help others. Down in verse 23, her husband is known in the gates. She protects his reputation. She helps him be a man of respect. She helps him be a success in every way. When he sits among the elders of the land, she makes linen garments and sells them. She supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. You know, God says those that honor him, he will honor. It's also true in the human family. When you honor other people, you will also eventually receive honor. Verse 27, she watches over the ways of her household, does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. They love their mother. They call her blessed. She disciplines them. She teaches them. and she works with them to raise them into successful adults. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing. But the woman who fears the Lord, and that's the bottom line of this entire chapter, a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. And then it ends this book of Proverbs by saying, give her of the fruit of her hands. Sort of like saying your reward is according to your works. You'll receive back double what you give to others. And her own gates works, or let her own works praise her in the gates. So her successful life of being a wife and a mother, because she understands her covenant with her husband and lives to fulfill her covenant with God, all come back in a very positive and beautiful way. And this chapter is for men and for women, because men have to learn to be a Proverbs 31 husband, just like the wife does Proverbs 31 in her life. The important thing, though, is not to forget the missing dimension in marriage, because all of this keys on understanding that you have made a covenant with your wife or with your husband, and importantly, that third being in that covenant is you have made a promise and a vow to God.